Walter,
that column of sermons, it doesn't take, it takes organization, and it takes looking through them to make sure that nothing highly antagonistic is said.
And where is it printed?
In the Jewish Chronicle. And every once in a while, I forget to look at somebody's column, and there's a little to do afterwards, but generally it works.
Walter, I've got to backtrack because, again, I have to remind us all that we're doing redoing a tape. One of the changes that you made shortly after Dr. Freiheit retired or resigned is that you've made more visitations to homes, to hospitals, etc.
Right, this is the next matter. Doing, making the congregation much more personal and seeing to it that pastoral calls and hospital visits and visits on shut-ins are made to the extent possible. Now, it's easy to expand that. It's very difficult to really carry out. So early on, a group was enlisted from Brotherhood and Sisterhood to help with this. Because, again, if there are two rabbis and you have, let's say, three funerals a week, and maybe three or four other people in the congregation become bereaved during the week, so that's six condolence calls, and there are 25 people in the hospital, and they are scattered all over creation because our congregation is scattered, you're not going to get to all those people. It's just not going to happen.
So how do you make your selection?
Well, I've always done the calls on the bereaved first, hospitals second, and additional visits third. That means that most older folks during most of these years, unless we had three rabbis, were neglected because it just wasn't time to do it. And it also means that you've got to be pretty careful about looking at people and seeing who needs help and who doesn't. So some people stopping in and visiting for a half hour, that's fine. Other people you're going to have to go back to several times or suggest that somebody else goes back. And there's no doubt about it that in spite of every effort, lots of people were neglected and lots of people were justifiably angry. But with two rabbis, you just can't do it. Of course, the other part of it is that there are time constraints. I used to make hospital calls first thing in the morning, which meant 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. But
you were like the doctor.
Men usually don't mind. Women are usually quite unhappy if you come in to their room at that hour. And so then it becomes impossible because you can't start selecting the men and not the women. And you can't make condolence calls past about 9:30 at night. So there are limits. I mean, sometimes, of course, you can excuse yourself from meetings and wander off. But otherwise, you're limited to Sunday afternoon. If you have two funerals on Sunday afternoon, you're stuck. I mean, the calls you intended to make aren't going to be made. But nevertheless, that was important, as was we had always dealt with converts very personally. And in fact, up to the last maybe 6 years, conducted the conversion classes for the whole city, because I always insisted that we do this all year long. Somebody wants to convert, don't tell them come to me in 3 months. Simply say, all right, start next week. It doesn't matter where you start in this process because you will not understand all of it till you've gone through the cycle.
Is this usually a preamble to a marriage?
If it's a, yes, if the person is not Jewish. I've always insisted that both, if I'm going to officiate, that both parties be Jewish. And that was true of Dr. Freiheit as well.
What happens if they decide to be married elsewhere by someone else who will officiate, and then still come back into the congregation?
They can join. They're more than welcome in the congregation. People are encouraged to raise their children as Jews. But
if they don't?
If they don't, that's their business. To my mind, a division between saying, I approve of this, and I see no difference between a Jewish wedding and a non-Jewish wedding.
You don't?
No, I do.
Excuse me, okay.
And officiating. And so I won't officiate at a mixed marriage. And there are also limits to the participation in the congregation. The membership is held by the Jewish party. And that's really the only way it can be, because otherwise you end up with this strange anomaly of somebody being divorced. Now you have a totally non-Jewish member in the congregation who may marry another non-Jew. Now you have two non-Jews who are members of the congregation and who can vote on everything that comes to the congregation, which, granted, doesn't happen very often, anything of importance, but can elect a rabbi.
What is the worst scenario, then, that can occur? Let's assume that happens.
The worst scenario is that a Jewish decision is made by a series of non-Jews. And
such as?
Who's the next rabbi? Are you going to change prayer books? Are you going to follow a different set of customs? Are you going to have a day school? Are you going to have this or that in the religious school curriculum? You know, all those things should be decided by people who are Jewish.
Okay, assume, regardless of what the marriage, how a marriage is performed, even if it is non-Jewish, you recognize that those people are being married.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they're married and...
And what about their children? Let's say that they children come, but they're not mother or the father. Let's assume the mother did not convert.
We consider them as Jews by education. And have really always done that, and have made that, I can't say always, but probably for 100 years. Made that official in the mid-80s through a resolution which dealt with patrilineal descent.
It didn't have to be matrilineal.
Well, actually, patrilineal descent is not a good term for this, because what we've said is that it goes a little further than that. That descent, that to be considered Jewish requires a commitment.
Not of Jewish mother.
Not just descent.
Okay.
And so if you have decided to raise your children as Jews, and they in fact go to religious school, then the children are to be considered as Jews.
So it's by education, not by patrilineal or matrilineal.
Yeah, or commitment of some kind. If somebody comes to me as an adult, they have not had the education, I will suggest that they go to the conversion class. But if they have said to me, look, I wasn't raised as a Jew, but I have in my adult life up to now participated in the American Jewish Committee and the Federation and have gotten myself involved in that, so clearly have made a commitment to be Jewish, even if they don't know very much, then okay, I'll consider them as Jews and go ahead and marry.
So at what point, Walter, did the matrilineal, I know in the Orthodox tradition, the child is supposedly the religion of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did Reform Judaism make that change or a commitment as you did, that education was really
We
different?
Made that change unofficially, you might say de facto, about 100 years ago, mm-hmm. De jure in the 1980s. But of course you have to ask another question, which you didn't ask, and that is, at what point did Orthodoxy decide on matrilineal descent rather than patrilineal descent? And the answer to that is, I don't know. But you can see from the Bible that mothers didn't particularly matter. And in some ways that's continued. A Kohen, a priest, is a priest because his father is a priest, not his mother is a priest. Mother can be an Israelite. And the descent all along in the biblical period is patrilineal. Sometime in the early rabbinic period, it changed. Exactly why and when is open for speculation. And I can give you a whole long essay I wrote on that.
What, I'd like to read that, because I noticed that in your bibliography. But isn't it basically a very, wasn't it a practical reason that a mother knows? You know that who the mother is because the mother has given birth.
Yes, but that was true in biblical times as well as later.
My assumption was that's why.
Yeah, but you see, that's not a good reason, because you always knew that. So then it should have been that in biblical times too. I don't know. Nobody really knows. And it's open for speculation.
What is your opinion? You feel education and...
Oh, but I feel that for us in our period, in our age, this is going to be dominant. It's kind of crazy to say, as you know, this was a famous Israeli case, that a priest came to Israel, claimed automatic citizenship in the country because his mother was Jewish. He's a Catholic priest. All right.
He was a Holocaust survivor, is that correct?
No, he was just a priest. Now, should this person be considered Jewish ethnically and allowed the privileges of... Because the state of Israel says that if you are Jewish and you arrive there, you can vote and have all the privileges of citizenship. If you are a Christian and arrive, you go through a period of becoming a part of the state.
And then asking for a citizenship.
Yes.
I was under the impression that he was a converted child from the Holocaust.
No,
sorry.
I don't think so. I don't think
my impression.
But in any case, this has arisen a couple of times. So clearly we and the Israelis also feel that education is, in this regard, they also feel that.
Even now, since the conservative movement is so strong? And
well, the interestingly enough, the citizenship laws of Israel are very convoluted. On the one hand, it's this. On the other hand, they say that a person, I've forgotten the exact wording, but it comes out to roughly this, that if the person has Jewish descent, either in the previous generation or the generation before that, of any kind, he's to be considered Jewish. Which is not terribly far from the Nazi definition of who is Jewish. Now, this was, of course, done with an eye toward immigrants. Let people who are even vaguely Jewish claim that they are Jewish, because otherwise they may not be able to get out of the country where they are. And that was true in Russia. So if you had a Jewish grandmother, you could claim that and come to Israel. This is very far off from anything we've done here at Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. You also mentioned you needed an assistant, and your classmate Sherman Stein came here for just 3 years.
Yes. Well, being elected in, I think it was April or something like that, it was too late to go to the Hebrew Union College for a new graduate. They were all gone. And this was a time when the number of rabbis... the number of positions exceeded the number of rabbis, so it was very difficult to find anybody. So I asked my colleague Sherman Stein to come, and that was not an easy relationship because we were classmates. I obviously was going to be the senior rabbi, and he was going to be the assistant rabbi. and there were some things that he was going to have to do, which he, not that we share, we basically shared matters, but where I would be making the decision and he would not. But it worked out all right, and 3 years later, Fred Pomerantz came as the next assistant rabbi. It was not easy to find someone because the number of graduates was so small for whatever reason. But he is an exceptionally able person.
Called him gifted.
Yes. Very bright, a lot of originality, creative ideas, an unusual way of working with teenagers and young people, sensing what they want and programming it in a Jewish way. So we had marvelous creative services, which some of the congregants, some of the more conservative congregants, of course, did not appreciate, like having five enormous screens on a pulpit, each of them about 10 by 15 feet, with the themes flashing as the service went on, or a jazz service, which he created and went and took across the country and recorded. We took a tour, literally, across the whole United States.
The kids loved him.
Yes. Oh, he was terrific. And it was difficult. I remember trying to persuade Milton Harris to support this service. It was not a lot of money, less than $1,000, and it took a lot of persuasion.
Did Milton Harris support you?
You mean in this service?
Yeah. No, I mean when you were voted into.
Yeah. Or put it this way, I know, but I'm not going to comment.
Okay, fine. All right.
But
I'd be remiss as an interviewer if I didn't ask you that. That's my opinion as an interviewer. Okay.
But
the coffee houses.
Well, see, the next thing he did, and that was most successful, were high school and college coffee house. We had a room in the basement which was not used for anything, and we set up a stage there and had up to, well, we had more kids than the fire laws would allow. So we, after a while, had to engage an off-duty policeman to keep people out until some people had left. And then they could come in. And the interesting thing about him was also that he was able to arrange, he himself is a jazz musician, able to arrange programming, as were his successors, Evans, I think. I better look up the name so I get it right, a young couple, who eventually became program directors for the Jewish Welfare Board in New York, nationally. They had their ears out for who was in town. So if somebody was in town speaking or giving a jazz performance somewhere, they'd often come here, play for 20 minutes, no cost, just go on and play somewhere else. Or some speaker, usually somebody fairly radical, would come here and speak and then go on. And of course, there were always people who were upset by that. And so I spent a lot of time defending his choices and saying, you know, we've got to listen to both sides on these issues. You may not like this, but we've got to hear this. He was extremely able, and also I think I mentioned we divided the clock. He really was a nighttime person and functioned very well late at night. I can still call him at midnight, and did not function all that well in early in the day. So, all right, so we divided things in that fashion, by time as well as by efforts. But it, really, one of the most gifted people I've worked with.
It sounds like you work around different people and different personalities very well.
Well, I guess that's the way it should be. But I've followed to some extent. Well, I can't really say it. I followed Dr. Prioff in this way because he stepped out of a lot of things. I decided not to, and decided instead to divide things across the board, so that there wasn't whoever was with me was not in charge of the religious school. We both were involved and taught and led services and worked with the kids and really did everything, you know, preaching and calling and counseling and whatever.
You have a wonderful way of consecrating the kids with the confirmation. It was just a lovely ceremony with your hands.
Well, it's always fun to deal with kids, and it's...
It shows.
Well, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Some confirmation classes are... You talk, you might as well be talking to the brick wall. You get the same reaction. So then you have to try to find some way of loosening those bricks and getting the kids.
So what are some of the ways that you do loosen those bricks?
Well, sometimes you do it by bringing in somebody. Sometimes you do it by role-playing. Sometimes you do it by saying something that is so outrageous that kids have to react.
Such as?
I won't give you any examples.
You're not going to give us your trick. You talked about Milton Sussman.
Yes.
And that his son was now a rabbi.
Milt's son is a rabbi, yes, and a whole series of people from the congregation have become rabbis, and he's one of them. Milt Sussman was youth group advisor when I came, and really remained in some ways involved with the youth group till his death in his 80s. He had an unusual ability to deal with kids.
You said he was a perpetual teenager.
He was. Not only in the way in which he acted with the kids, but also in what you can expect of kids and what you can't. And so if there was a service, a teenage service out in the country, and I usually came too, he inevitably forgot the prayer books or, you know, some other support function that he should have done he didn't do, just as teenagers would.
He wrote a column as well, didn't he?
Yes. Had a column, a very lively column, and I rather miss that because he took opposing points of view. After he was gone, the Jewish Chronicle has become, you might say, the favorite newspaper of Prince Charles because it prints only good news. Never any controversy.
Are you saying that there's good news being printed about Prince Charles?
He only wants to hear good
news. Yeah, he said that once for one of his birthdays, and the London Times, I believe, then accommodated him on the front page and printed only nice things
nice
that happened
things.
In the world.
Can't sell a newspaper that way, can you?
But that was more or less like a Purim edition.
One thing that you mentioned, and I'm going to backtrack for a minute because I waiting for Gabi here today. I read the Temple Bulletin probably better than I read it when it comes to my house. It mentions that the Purim festival has to do with the children coming and helping build the sukkah. That's a relatively new thing, isn't it? That the sukkah is.
Well, we have a number of sukkahs.
Okay.
You have to remember that. The one in the main temple doesn't lend itself to much children's participation. Because first of all, it is a fairly formal thing with lots of flowers, which kids are not interested in, and then you have to stand on a fairly high ladder. The one in the garden court, we've always had kids participate in that, and in various times have also had sukkahs built in the various corners of the parking lot. You know, classes wanted to do that.
Walter, you're looking at your watch. Do you want us to stop?
Well, I'll have to stop at 5:25. We have another 6 minutes.
All right, 1 second, please. Let's just go on then. Okay. You talked about Sammy Levin. Mimi Lerner, we know she's an opera star. I think we should put that down on the...
Well, it took a while to to get a cantorial soloist as part of the scene. And she was not the first cantorial soloist. We had a number of individuals. And this was a way of getting two things done. One is getting a person to musically lead the service who was not up there but down below and could engage the people somewhat. And in the early years, it was also a way of getting a woman onto the pulpit. We didn't have a woman rabbi, but that meant that there was a visible female presence on the pulpit. The people have been of varying calibers as far as voice goes. And Mimi is, of course, by far the best, but we've had some others who were also quite good.
You also have some very fine ones up above who are not Jews, is that correct, in the chorus?
Yes, they are mixed. For a while, we had a Jewish organist, Heidi Block, but she only stayed 3 years. This was an effort to get more Jewish music, Jewish feeling into the service, because it's not just a matter of music, it's also how you play it.
Barbara Stamey, I think, is part of the chorus.
Oh, we've had a variety, yeah. Many people.
And the organist today, what is his name?
The current organist, we don't have a Jewish organist. Mr. Pearson was organist for 50 years and certainly did his best to accommodate my desire for changes in music, because he had gone back all the way to Dr. Goldenson. You know, that was a rather radical change from Goldenson through Freehoff to me. After that, we had Roger Evans, a very gifted musician who was also professor of music at the University of Pittsburgh, and now then went to New York to a large church, and now holds a position which is both academic and publishing. And that was followed by Jenkins, Wilcox Jenkins, who is both a composer and a choir director. And I'm going to have to stop, and we'll go on with
okay,
the current
fine.
One.